Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. You are listening to our 2017 daily Iditarod coverage here on Mushing Radio. You can hear us over on KVRF 89.7 in the Matsu Valley. You can find all of our episodes over on iTunes. Just search for Dog Works Radio. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter as well under the same name. Calling in from California is the co-host of our show. His name is Alex Stein. Alex, how are you doing today?
I am doing great today, Robert. It's, it's still early in the race, but it feels like the race has been going on for quite a bit. It's been a very, very fast race, and, it's hard to tell too much at the beginning. We're about a day and a half in, but it looks like it is shaping up to be a very interesting and very fast race.
It has, and I'm looking at the current standings right now. It looks like Ali Zirkle, Yor Olsom, Peter Kaiser, Michelle Phillips, and rounding out the top five, Ray Reddington Jr. are all out of Manly and on their way to Tanana. Is that correct?
Yeah, just checking the tracker right now, it looks like temporarily, and there's a lot of leapfrogging, but Nick Pettit is in the lead right now, about a mile ahead of Martin Boozer. They're both about 30 miles outside of Tanana. And then after them, Wade Mars, Pete Kaiser, Mitch Seavey, Jeff King, Jason Mackey, Dallas Seavey, Ali, Ryan Reddington. And we've got within about 15 miles of the leader, we have about 20 teams. So there's a very big pack at the front. And then way back at the end, we have Ellen Halverson and Larry Doherty keeping up the rear. Ellen Halverson, people may remember, is actually the only musher who has won the Red Lantern twice.
Right. I'm looking right now on Iditarod.com on their standings page where it lists where everybody's at, sort of in a spreadsheet type deal. And you know what's not on there this year, Alex? Usually at the bottom is the withdrawn or scratched mushers. Are they somewhere else this year?
They seem to have redone part of their standings thing. So that there are a couple different ones that I've seen, and I've seen one that I think I'm looking at the one you're looking at, and it doesn't have that. I've also seen another standings page, and I'm not sure exactly where that is. I'll have to figure that out later. That does have them, but yeah, it's I know that they're always tweaking things and trying to make things a little bit better on the website. And it looks like this year, one of the things that they've done is on the page where they have the standings and the in and out times of.
Are you there, Alex? It looks like we may have lost Alex. Hopefully he gives a call right back in. We are conducting our 2017 Iditarod coverage here on Mushing Radio. My name is Robert Forto, and my co-host is Alex Stein, and he is back on. Let's pull him back up. There you go, Alex. Looks like we dropped your call.
Yep, sorry about that. Anyway, as I was saying, they also seem to have redone the standings page so that now you can click from the standings page to various stories that are up on other parts of Iditarod about different mushers coming into different checkpoints. So it looks like they are making a big effort to make their website a much more friendly kind of place where you don't have to You don't have to go to other sources for information about Iditarod. You can just stay within Iditarod.com.
So, Alex, you know, the first story I want to talk a little bit about tonight is a story about Martin Boosser. I guess he pulled into Manly Hot Springs earlier last night, early this morning, and he immediately declared his 24-hour rest, and he bedded down and took a nap, whatever, and then 6 hours later jumped up and took off. I did not know that that was allowed. I thought that once you called your rest that you had to stay, which is a very interesting strategy in of itself at the, I guess that would be the second checkpoint on a 1,000-mile race, 100-some-odd miles in. But I guess the rules state you can withdraw that declare any time. Have you heard about this one?
You know, I heard about this story today as well, and I also was under the impression that when you declared it, you had to stay. But apparently, that's not the case, and apparently the way the rule works is that the clock doesn't start running for your 24 until you declare it. So that perhaps is why sometimes people will be in a checkpoint for, you know, slightly longer than 24 hours, for, you know, 24 and 15 minutes or 20 minutes. So it doesn't actually start until you declare it, but apparently you can cancel that and decide that you want to leave if circumstances change. That creates the possibility that you could have some mushers, especially mushers who are used to playing kind of mind games with their competitors. You could have them declare 24s, and then other people would think that they were safe, and there, you know, we might have a situation like a few years back where Lance Mackey snuck out while Jeff King was sleeping. So I guess potentially you could have someone declare a 24. One of the competitors could come in, think that they had a little bit of time to relax and get some rest. And then the person who declared could say, no, I changed my mind, and just, you know, jet out of there.
Right. And another quick story I wanted to talk about, it didn't come to fruition, but I thought it was a really interesting concept. It was about my man Nick Pettit, the guy I hope to win this year. They were speculating that he had a strategy of doing this year's Iditarod in 10 equal 100-mile runs. And I had never heard of that strategy before. Typically, it's about a 40 to a 60-mile run as a pretty typical run-rest schedule. But boy, just imagine knocking out 10 runs consecutively, barring that you do have to take those mandatories. But I think that that might be the wave of the future. What do you think?
You know, it's very interesting, because one of the things that I've been looking at and reading about in the past day or so is Martin Boozer, who, you know, as we know, is a four-time champion and a very well-respected and great dog man, had decided a few years ago that his old strategy that he had used, his old run-rest schedule, wasn't really working for him, and he needed to do something to change it up. And as a result, we've seen Martin in the past few years take these very, very long runs early in the race and really, in some cases, get way, way out in front. And that's worked in some years. He had a sixth place finish a couple years back, and in other years he has just, you know, exhausted his dogs and hasn't been able to be competitive in the latter half of the race. But I think that we're really moving towards a future where there's going to be the really competitive racers are going to figure out something different, maybe something we haven't even seen yet in terms of running, and I think we're going to see longer types of runs in years to come. And I forget who it was, but there was, it may have even been Martin, there was someone a couple years back who basically did the first 24 hours with almost no rest. You know, obviously,
right.
There was,
I believe,
a little bit
was him.
Yeah, there was a little bit of rest to snack the dogs and feed them, but he basically just went pedal to the metal for the first 24 hours of the race.
Right.
So I would be excited to see someone try to do 10 equal 100-mile runs.
So what's on your radar today? Those two stories popped up on mine. Do you have anything different you would like to talk about?
You know, I just wanted to talk a little bit about while we're getting into run rest strategies. It's interesting to me that one of the people who is so far out in front this early in the race is Dallas Seavey. And in the past, we've seen Dallas very, very successfully hang back and, take a little bit less rest at each checkpoint, at each stop, but really basically hang back in the middle of the pack until about halfway into the race and then really start to make his move, what he refers to as the building the monster strategy. It's interesting to me to see Dallas so far out in front, with the front pack this early in the race. And I'm wondering if that's because, it's a faster course. It's colder. It seems like a lot of people are doing longer runs where they're going fairly fast throughout the run. And I'm wondering if this is a different sort of strategy with Dallas, or if he's just feeling like he needs to compete and can't afford to fall behind people like Mitch and Martin.
You know, my only comment to that was we talked a lot about his sled last night on the show, and I guess there in Enana he was timing himself, moving his dogs around, and he did it, I guess, in 14 minutes or something like that. And he had done an interview, or they had spoken to a handler or something, and they said that he is doing all that timing so he can gradually whittle that down so it equals up more rest or more run time during the race. Did you get a chance to read that article as well?
I did. And it's, I just have to say again that his sled is just a remarkable thing. I saw someone had posted a picture of it this afternoon and said that it was rumored that this sled cost $10,000. To,
wow.
to build, and it's a custom-made sled. So, with carbon and I imagine it's very, very big, but I imagine it's lightweight because of the materials that are used. It seems like I'm wondering if that's the sled he's going to use all the way through, or try to use all the way through, because I would think that at a certain point, maybe when he's down to whatever 10 or 11 dogs, that he might want a lighter sled. But then again, if you have this sled where you can carry four dogs in it, maybe that's his strategy and he's going to keep it all the way through.
You know, you had mentioned $10,000. That's about three times more than the majority of the sleds out there cost. Both of my racing sleds are about $3,000 sleds, and those are pretty high-tech ones from Sled Dog Systems, the same company that provides sleds to Jeff King and Rick Casillo and Monica Zappa and all sorts of other folks down the trail. So that is a huge jump in price for that piece of technology. But I guess if you're the best, you might as well buy the best if you can afford it.
Yeah, and, maybe, who knows, maybe a couple of years from now they'll be mass producing these sleds and they'll be $4,000 instead of $10,000. But, I was having a discussion with someone earlier about whether using that sled, and clearly using that sled is something that is legal under the rules, but whether it really goes against the spirit new rule about the trailers was supposed to be. So I'm wondering what your take is on that.
You know, I'm a tech junkie. I love looking at and reading about and finding out about new technology. And I will tell you, just at any race, there are, if there's 70 entrants in a race, there's 70 different sled modifications from one way or the other. One of the keys to mushing is setting up that sled so it's dialed in the way you want it. Very similar to the way you would do your bike or the options you put on your car. You know, yeah, everybody can go buy a stock Hyundai from the dealership, but when you start adding wheels and high performance tires and different radios and all that sort of stuff, it becomes your own. It becomes what you want to drive. And I think that's exactly what's happening not only with Dallas, but with what everybody is doing. And of course, Dallas is getting all the press because he's the champ. He's got the flashy sled. He's got the media connections. But I bet there's a whole bunch of modifications out there, just like Dallas's. I know I saw a picture of Jeff leaving. I don't know if he was leaving the start or if he was leaving Nenana, and he had his stovepipe in his trailer with smoke coming out of it. So that is a very new innovation to come on board. I know Lance Mackey worked with that type of system a couple of years ago. In fact, when he was filming his documentary, he was using sort of a cooker on the go system, and just all sorts of things like that are coming on board that the general public just doesn't see. They're just used to the classic wooden stanchion, plastic runner type sleds, and I think those are a thing of the past.
It could very well be. I mean, everything is moving towards more flexible, more lightweight, more futuristic, space age polymers, as they used to say. So it very well could be that the days of, handcrafted wooden sleds and old fashioned sleds are just gone.
And, on the other side of that, Alex, I'm also a purist as well. Even though I love my tech, I love to maintain a lot of the purity in things, not only in mushing, but other things that I do. And I will be kind of sad if, the old school tech goes away. You know, nowadays everybody's wearing these fancy lightweight Gore-Tex suits. You know, back in the days people were wearing furs and, everybody's wearing this really high-tech gear and high-tech boot systems and all of this sort of stuff, and now even we have high-tech harnesses, and of course that's progress in any type of technology, but I'll be a little sad when some of that old-school stuff leaves as well.
Yeah. One more thing that I wanted to mention, one more story that I saw today was, I believe it was on Iditarod.com, they had an interview with several of the trail breakers who were talking about the trail. And we've heard reports that there was just a ton of snow and that it was going to be very, very slow and that it would be hard to get through parts of the trail this year. And in this interview, one of the trail breakers said, and I thought this was very amusing actually, that every year the reports on the trail are that it is the worst trail ever. That every year that he's been involved with the race, people have reports about that there is too much snow or there's too little snow or, it's too cold or it's too warm, and that every year is just different. And what they do as the trail breakers is to just go through and make sure that the trail is passable and is good. And, I think it's easy, especially for some of us armchair mushers, to just get, we read reports that the trail is bad, and then we start panicking and thinking, oh my God, this is going to be horrible. Whereas the trail is the trail, and the best trails will get broken up by teams coming through and riding a break, and the worst trails sometimes, being behind people who have gone through will make it a little bit easier. So I guess the point is it's easy to make these kind of generalizations about the trail, but what I got out of this article was that a lot of times these types of generalizations are just wrong.
You know, that's part of the game, isn't it, Alex? Just like in any other sport, you have to speculate. And, you know, people that play fantasy football, they live and breathe by the injury report. Who is playing, who's probable, who's questionable, who's out. And you develop your entire roster based on that injury report that it's released on Thursday before the weekend games with football. So I think a lot of that is the same with mushing, whether it's the trail report or, you know, the weather report or where people are going to possibly be in the next 100 miles. I just think speculation is name of the game.
Absolutely. And, you know, as the front of the race is moving down the Tanana River and going up towards the Yukon, that is typically, from what I've read, that there's not typically a lot of local traffic that goes on that river. But again, the trail breakers went through and put a trail in. So there is a trail that can be followed, and it may not be the best trail, but it's what the trail is.
And that's part of the race. You know, back in the day, they walked a good portion of the trail with snowshoes, and that's definitely something that has fallen away into the past. And that's, I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing or a bad. Okay, Alex, we have 8 minutes to go. Let's jump over to our musher profile of the evening. You're going to talk about Mark May. And he's an interesting character. He ran the race a long time ago, and he is back. And he has a story about that, doesn't he?
Yeah. So Mark May is 60. We seem to be focusing a lot on mushers who are, you know, in their 50s and 60s, at least right now. And he was raised in the Midwest. And started mushing in 1974. He's lived in Fairbanks for most of that time, and has run the Iditarod, as you said, exactly once. He ran it in 1998, and he came in 20th place and was actually Rookie of the Year. And normally when someone has that good a finish, and certainly when people are named Rookie of the Year, it's usually the start of a you know, long Iditarod career. But up until this year, he has not run again. And he said that it was because he had a family and a veterinary practice in Fairbanks, and his wife told him that once his kids were grown and out of the house that he could go back and run the Iditarod again. And now this year at age 60, he is doing that. This is someone who, although he hasn't been competitively racing all that much, has always been around dogs, works with a lot of dogs and a lot of mushers. He said that when he first started mushing, that he was mentored by a lot of old-time Iditarod mushers and a lot of old-time Alaskan mushers. And then he said that he, when he was working as a veterinarian, had clients, very famous dog musher clients, such as George Atla, and would always try to pick the brain of his musher clients about their attitudes towards dogs and towards racing, and said that was a very valuable thing that he was able to learn. He's got I guess you'd call it a medium-sized kennel, about 40 dogs, and he is, you know, he's someone who just has always looked to breed his own dogs and looked to, you know, looked at what their body type and hair type is in terms of his breeding program. And he says that he looks for dogs that have tight, tough feet so that they can run a little bit better. And he's gone through, you know, over the years, a lot of dogs and bred some really great dogs and and has been someone who is has always been on the front line of like looking at what makes each of these dogs a good athlete, a good musher. So it's very interesting to see someone who comes from the veterinary side. We've seen a lot of people who race Iditarod who come from the human medical side, doctors and nurses and surgeons and psychiatrists. I'm sure there are other vets, but I this is the first one that I'm really aware of. He says that he likes to train heavily his dogs starting in the fall, and then start taking them out when it gets snowy, start training them on quads and things like that. And then he said that he spends about $20,000 a year maintaining his dogs and maintaining his kennel, and has said that one of his big strengths as a musher is that he doesn't require very much sleep, which, as we've talked about, is something you don't get a lot of on the Iditarod Trail. But he's also said that as a musher, he thinks his primary weakness is that he doesn't have a strong killer instinct. So he's not one of these guys like a Dallas Eby or a Lance Mackey who will just look at how he can get ahead and how he can get any kind of advantage. But he also says that every time he enters a race, he thinks that there is a possibility that he can win. So it's an interesting mixture of confidence and sort of realism that he brings to the sport. He's talked a lot about, as we've talked about in the past, that one of the things that happens every time he does a race is that towards the end of the race, he starts having hallucinations brought on by sleep deprivation, which he says are very interesting. When he ran Iditarod in 98, part of the reason that he was able to finish so strong and get Rookie of the Year is that he had a 100-mile run from Shaktulik to Koyuk. And he said he wasn't quite sure that was going to be his strategy, but he kept passing racers who had their dogs resting and looked at his dogs and thought, yeah, I can do this and I can keep going. And he had that, what a lot of mushers talk about with that connection to his dogs, where he just knew instinctively what they were capable of and was able to know when to push and when not to push. He is currently way in the back of the pack. He is, I believe, second to last at the moment. It's exciting for me to see someone who has run the race before and had a long layoff, time off, and then is coming back and seems to have a really great attitude about the race, which is, I'm here for the dogs and I'm here to see the amazing scenery in Alaska.
Very quickly, Alex, you had mentioned that he ran in 98 and he is now running here in 17, a 19-year gap. But he started when he was a little over 40 years old, and he came back at 60. And you had mentioned that typically a rookie of the year has a very promising career ahead of him. I just wonder if he's going to be a late bloomer and then all of a sudden just be a rock star in Iditarod, and for the next 15 years or so, just rocking and rolling up there with the old timers.
Well, he said that one of his goals is to keep coming back and to run this race for the next 10 or 15 years. Obviously people get a little bit slower when they get into their 60s and 70s, but we've seen a bunch of people who have run Iditarod in the past and a bunch of people running this year. And, you can make your arguments about whether it's possible for someone to win the race when they're in their 60s. but it's definitely possible for people to run the race and finish the race and do, you know, and finish very respectably when they're in their 60s and even in their 70s.
Excellent. All right, Alex, who do you want to talk about tomorrow on day three of our coverage?
Okay, so tomorrow, keeping with what seems to be the trend of slightly older mushers, we're going to be talking about Joe Carson.
Excellent. All right, we'll talk Carson tomorrow on day three of our coverage. Again, you can find all of our episodes over on iTunes if you search for Dog Works Radio. Follow us along on Twitter. Alex is at Coldfoot Films, and I think he's up as long as the mushers are during Iditarod, 24-hour stretches at a time. And you can follow me as well over there at Robert Forto, F-O-R-T-O. And we're also pretty active over on Facebook as well. Just search for Dog Works Radio. Alex, we'll talk again, okay?
Okay, thanks, Robert.
Thank you. On behalf of my co-host, Alex Stein, this is Robert Forto. We will see you guys tomorrow night. Goodbye.